The Bob Murphy Show, episode 25.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, it's Bob Murphy here. I am going to introduce now and replay for you a recent discussion I had with CJ Engel on his Austro-Libertarian podcast titled MMT Through the Eyes of a Socialist. So no, don't worry, this isn't turning into all MMT all the time. It's just, it's so hot right now, as Will Ferrell would say. And so CJ had me on, and the particular item of discussion was a recent article in Jacobin magazine by Doug Henwood. And he was critical of MMT, even though he's a socialist. All right. So it was a very well-researched, knowledgeable article. Obviously, we didn't go full socialist on it. But I think you'll enjoy our discussion. And it gives more of the academic background of MMT as opposed to Warren Mosler's real world out in the trenches in the financial sector path to the insights of MMT that I've been focusing on here at the Bob Murphy Show. So without further ado, here's going to be my interview with CJ Engel on his podcast entitled MMT Through the Eyes of a Socialist.
Welcome to the Austro-Libertarian Podcast, Episode 9. This is CJ Engel, creator of AustroLibertarian.com. Today, I'm talking with Bob Murphy about MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. Bob has sort of been the default go-to Austrian on trying to understand trendy monetary theories and how they compare to the Austrians. He's talked about MMT quite a bit over the last 18 to 24 months, and I don't want this to be a repetition of everything that's already been said. But I do want to discuss this from a particular angle. I want to use a recent essay from Jacobin magazine. And I want to talk about this essay because the author is sort of a neo-Marxist. So for most of my readers and listeners, and you know, because this podcast is brand new, I definitely have more readers at the moment. But in any case, most people understand the extent to which I personally am interested in the rising trend of Marxism and democratic socialism, which, as I indicated last week, I don't really see as the same thing. But I've paid particular attention over the last couple of years toward this publication, Jacobin Magazine, and also its sister academic publication called Catalyst. If we were to compare these publications to what we have on the Austrian side, Catalyst is more like the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and Jacobin is more of their layman audience focus. So, you know, and I created our new print publication, Austro-Libertarian Magazine, which you can find out more about at austrolibertarian.com/magazine. But like Jacobin, we're a print publication with around a dozen exclusive and original essays, articles, and features to the tune of over 100 pages per quarterly print. It's in color, it's elegantly designed, and it features writers such as Chris Calton, George Pickering, and Ben Lewis, who was recently on The Tom Woods Show. So besides my own interest in Jacobin magazine and the impact that I believe they're having on the intellectual left, there's a very real fact that democratic socialism is on the climb. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has recently indicated her own interest in MMT. But, you know, whether her interest goes beyond the fact that it's more palatable to her audience to praise money creation schemes rather than taxation, or she really does take it seriously, remains to be seen. But here we have this article, this essay in Jacobin magazine that doesn't praise MMT, but's rather harsh toward it. So, Bob, you and I have both read this essay, and it's quite a long one. And it's called Modern Monetary Theory Isn't Helping, and it's written by someone named Doug Henwood. I think some people may be a little surprised that a socialist would come out against MMT, since it seems popular on the left these days. But I think anyone who really understands and has studied Marxist money theory shouldn't be that surprised. you know, because Marx actually, despite all of his myriad faults, was actually a hard money advocate, albeit for the wrong reasons. He and Lenin were against inflationary paper money. I don't think a lot of people realize this. In fact, there's an article, a quick little article on Mises that I'll link to on the show notes page by Louis Renault called, he wrote on this a couple of years ago. So I'll link to that as well. But anyways, Bob, let's start with a bird's eye view of all of this. And I don't want to spend too much time defining MMT since you've done that elsewhere, but in just, you know, a minute or so, could you summarize it? Is it basically just this descriptive statement about why budgetary government finance thinking is old school and basically outdated?
Sure. So thanks, CJ. I can't recommend highly enough this Doug Henwood article. As you say, it's kind of ironic from our point of view that it's coming from Jacobin Magazine, but this is the single most helpful link to just bring someone up to speed about the academic roots and the implications of MMT that I've seen. And it's very interesting that this guy Henwood, that you would think would be real sympathetic, is actually coming out against it as well. In terms of the modern political debate, the reason this is relevant again, because I debated this guy Warren Mosler a few years ago at Columbia University, and I think it was in 2013, actually. I could be wrong about that. And now this is having a resurgence. And so the reason for the newfound popularity is, as you mentioned, Ocasio-Cortez. She is behind the scenes being advised by Stephanie Kelton, who's a professor at Stony Brook, who was also advising the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. And so when Ocasio-Cortez gets cornered by the press and they say, how are you going to pay for the Green New Deal or whatever, universal health care and so forth, one of the things she'll say is, well, there's this doctrine of this school of thought called MMT, and I'm really sympathetic to that. So what in this context, what they're saying is it's wrong when people ask, how can the federal government pay for something, or how can we afford the Green New Deal? And they'll say, of course we can, that the United States government issues dollars. It's fiat money at this point. There's no gold backing. There's no constraints on how many dollars they can issue. And a secondary thing is that most of the debts held by the U.S. government, or the people, its own liabilities, are denominated in dollars, right? So there are some countries that issue their own fiat currency, but because they're tiny little countries, if they want to borrow money, it's got to be denominated in another country or another currency. So those countries can get into a debt crisis because if the exchange rate moves against them, the value of the debts they owe can blow up. Whereas if people hold treasuries that say you are owed $10,000 by the U.S. Treasury, there's no problem of satisfying that. The MMT people say, all you got to do is print up $10,000. Worst case scenario, there's no limit. So that's what their main point is. Is they're just saying these debates over the budget and can we afford to pay for these programs is misguided. They think that people are thinking of the government as a big corporation, and the MMT folks are saying that is totally wrong. One last little example just of how they try to flip the standard discussion is they'll say the way normal people think of it, they'll say, oh, the government needs to tax in order to raise revenue to then fund its spending programs. And if there's a shortfall, it needs to borrow to fill that gap. And the MMT people say, no, that's totally backwards. The government needs to first spend dollars into existence so that people in the private sector have dollars in the first place with which they can then pay their taxes. So the MMT people think it's exactly the opposite of how most people talk about it, that government needs to spend first in order to then be able to collect taxes. Another catchphrase they say is the purpose of taxation is not to raise revenue for the government to fund spending. The purpose of taxation is to control aggregate demand or to prop up the value of the dollar. Because, hey, if you have to pay taxes with these things called dollars, you're going to scramble to try to get your hands on some of them. And that's what gives the dollar purchasing power. So I'll stop there. But that's the kind of way the MMT people are weighing in on the current debates. And they just roll their eyes at, these dinosaurs who are still thinking in terms of how can the government afford these programs when, no, there's no constraint on affordability here.
And that's true not only of taxation, but also of government bonds as well, right? When it comes to government debt, they kind of think of it in the same way in regards to funding government expenditures via, its various borrowing mechanisms. They don't see that as a necessity either. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's one thing I asked Warren Mosler about, and he's one of the pioneers of this way of thinking. when he, I had him on my show, and I just said, hey, wouldn't it just be a lot simpler? Do you have any problem? Couldn't they just get rid of the money, the middleman? Like, in other words, instead of the federal government running a deficit and floating bonds to raise that revenue, and then the Fed creates dollars to then absorb that those debt securities, couldn't we just get rid of that altogether and just have the Treasury print up money to cover a budget shortfall? Just literally run the printing press to pay its bills if it doesn't have enough coming in through taxes. And he agreed with me. He said, yeah, that's actually equivalent to one of his own proposals. So yes, CJ, I'm answering your question that they think right now that the issuing of debt is just like a convoluted thing. It's a throwback to an older period when under the gold standard, there really were constraints, and that, you know, really did make sense to say, can we afford this? And if we don't have enough in taxation, we got to go borrow the money to make up the gap. Whereas they're saying now that's totally obsolete. That's not the issue.
Yeah. And that's a key point. And I do want to emphasize that, because I think people should understand the fact that it's not like the MMT folks have decided that, you know, for the last 300 years or whatever of, you know, North American history, all governments anywhere had to do was just print money. They recognize that given the structures in the past, like in the gold standard era, you couldn't just do that. It's just that because we now live in that post-reserve, you know, that post, you know, the difference between money substitutes and money itself, because we don't live in that era anymore, it's only now that we can operate under this new model.
Right, and that's where the term comes from, modern monetary theory. That's what they're trying to emphasize, is this is the way the world works now. Stop, you know, thinking in terms of the gold standard mentality.
So in that way, it's kind of a descriptive school of thought. It's not really prescriptive. They're not saying it's better this way. I mean, they probably do believe this, but they're not necessarily saying it's better that we live under these conditions than the gold standard conditions. They're really saying, well, given the nature of where we are, this is just the reality of how government could finance itself.
I think they're a little bit slippery on this, but you're right. And sometimes they'll say, hey, we're not taking a normative position here. We are just describing neutrally how the world works. And if you're getting all upset about it, you know, you're getting upset over accounting tautologies. What's your deal? We're not. But then they clearly do think they're adding something to the conversation. You know, in other words, they think the discussions that are fixated on how are we going to pay for the Green New Deal, they clearly think, oh, we can pay for the Green New Deal. In other words, there's no problem with the government funding the Green New Deal, and these critics are silly and they should be quiet. So clearly they're trying to influence policy. So I think they are being a little bit slippery when they, on the one hand, make it sound like, no, we're not recommending it. This is just a positive description of how the world works, when clearly they do have a particular point of view, or the type of people who embrace MMT. It's because they want the government to spend more, and they think that these objections against it are silly.
Right. Okay. So in this Henwood essay, he kind of goes into a little bit of detail about the roots of it. But one of my questions for you is, because you took the time to, you know, have a dialogue with Warren Mosler, and, you know, presumably you did this so you could refer back to it over the coming years, as if, you know, you actually talked to a major player, so people can't accuse you of misunderstanding it or making things up or something. But my question is, in your opinion, does Henwood's presentation of it concur with what you got out of Mosler? Because I know there's some variance, you know, in this broad MMT category, and there's various players, and we can talk about them. But do you think Mosler is pretty representative of what Henwood was talking about?
Okay, so that's a good question, and my answer is a little bit nuanced. So Mosler, just for your listeners who don't know, he's not an academic. He was working in the financial sector. He was in the bond markets. And then he just on his own was curious and started poking around, and then started just talking with various people and Federal Reserve officials and guys, you know, working at investment firms and so forth. And he just, I think like in the 90s on his own, started developing these ideas, and then hooked up with, I think Randall Ray was the guy he hooked up with. I might be getting mixed up as to which of these MMT, you know, pioneers he hooked up with originally. And so Mosler's not academic. So in Mosler's telling of the story, he invented all this stuff on his own, and then it was only after he was putting it out there, and then it was on this one guy's website in the comments, that somebody called it modern monetary theory, and then the term just stuck. Okay, so Moser didn't coin that term. He was just saying some random, you know, some guy that was went to their website and liked it, said, why don't you call it this? And then the people liked that. So, and then Moser said, once it was out there, then people started chiming in and saying, you know, what you're doing, it actually is very similar to, you know, Knapp's state theory of money in terms of where you think money comes from. And it's Abba Lerner. His functional finance, you know, it's got a lot of similar. And Mosler then would go back and start looking at that and go, oh yeah, this is so. In Mosler's version of it, it was original with him, but he's not saying he was the first person to independently think of all of these different ideas. And so what Henwood does is takes a more academic route and sort of gives the academic background talking about post-Keynesians and all that stuff. So I think the two accounts are compatible. They don't contradict each other, but there's a lot in the Henwood piece that Moser, you know, didn't come out in my interview with Moser, because in Moser's view, he just on his own figured this stuff out. And only after the fact did people start pointing to some of the academic precursors.
Okay. So in your opinion, a lot of the academic developments of this, so it's not like this whole phenomenon just came from the blogosphere. I mean, there's a side of it that did, but some of it did come from the academic space. Like, so when we think of Keynesianism and you think of the contributions of, you know, John Maynard Keynes and how he influenced governments, I mean, that was pure, you know, academia. That came from the intellectual class. MMT is kind of split on its influence in some ways. Some of it came from the blogosphere and some of it came from academia. But Henwood, of course, focuses more on people like Stephanie Kelton, right? That's her name, Stephanie Kelton. And she comes from the academic side, and so she was kind of an early pioneer. That's basically what Henwood says, and you've talked about her in passing, but I didn't realize that she, I guess I did. She came from, she was part of the Bernie campaign, and now she's part of Ocasio-Cortez. So there's that interesting dynamic of, you know, academic connection with the, you know, political atmosphere as well. But let me ask you this. So Henwood talks about the fact that some of this comes from the post-Keynesian world. To what extent do you think that's true? Because I think Austrians were very aware of sort of the meta conversations that happen in the developments of different schools of thought and their offshoots and some of that. Do you think Henwood's presentation of MMT is coming from post-Keynesianism as opposed to, you know, Milton Friedman's monetarism? Can you interact with that theme a little bit?
Sure. So what's definitely true is people that I like, James Galbraith, for example, you know, that he's, I would have associated him with a post-Keynesian mentality, and he's definitely a fan of MMT. And so certainly there are post-Keynesians who are associated with MMT, and a lot of the post-Keynesian perspective, you see that in MMT, if that's what you're asking. So that's, and also too, with this stuff, it gets pretty nuanced. It's sort of like how people who go to Mises.org, you know, they would understand the distinction if I were going to make it between someone who was more Hayekian versus someone who was more Rothbardian. Whereas, you know what I mean? Whereas somebody who just goes to MIT and gets a PhD in economics and they think that mathematical equations are the cutting edge of science and we want to make economics, to them, they might just, oh yeah, those are all crazy Austrians. You know what I mean? They might not make those fine distinctions. So I think there's a similar thing here that, you know, some Austrians who aren't really into the weeds on this might just say, oh yeah, Keynesians, they want bigger government spending to fix recessions. Whereas as you're saying, there's lots of different camps, and there's the neo-Keynesians and the post-Keynesians and the da-da-da-da-da. And so, yes, to answer your point, I think Henwood does a very good job of just quoting and documenting and showing that there is a definite affinity between the post-Keynesian school and MMT.
Yeah, so the reason I'm asking that is because I wanted to lead into Paul Krugman a little bit.
He's a new Keynesian.
So he would criticize MMT from the same position as his opposition to post-Keynesianism.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, so the post-Keynesians think Paul Krugman is like an establishment shill. So, yeah. And where that came up, for example, when, what's his name? When Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, came out, there was a, among its other flaws is Piketty has a quick, breezy discussion about the Cambridge Capital controversies where he says that for one thing, he just totally misstates what the debate was over. I mean, it's amazing for those who know what it was to see Piketty's treatment of it when he's got a book that's ostensibly about capital theory. But beyond that is he claimed that the solo won the debate when Paul Samuelson flat out conceded that, yeah, we lost technically, but, you know, empirically, it's probably not a big deal, blah, blah, blah. And so Krugman was defending Piketty and saying, yeah, there's some people, some heterodox economists that are out there trying to claim the Cambridge Capital controversy is a big deal. You don't even need to go bother yourself and look at it. But blah, blah. And Krugman was trying to brush another rug. And there were post-Keynesians chiming in, just correcting the record at that point and saying, no, Krugman's totally full of it. There's serious methodological problems with the mainstream neoclassical treatment of, you know, interest equals the marginal product of capital. You know, Joan Robinson pointed out these problems, and Schraffa pointed out the problems, and these guys at MIT following Robert Solow and now Paul Krugman are just using real simplified math models that assume away all the complexity. So it was a very Austrian critique, and, you know, I was chiming in. I reached out to Jamie Galbraith at the time and tried to see, could we do something, you know, a joint article critiquing Piketty. It didn't pan out, but because we agreed that Piketty's treatment of capital theory. So I'm saying, yes, in that particular, that's an example where Krugman was just defending the mainstream establishment position. And it's not just Austrians who thought he was wrong. It was even post-Keynesians.
Okay, so let's get a little bit into Henwood's criticism. One of the sentences here I think that's particularly interesting is because it's almost useful to us Austrians who, because one of the things that we pay attention to is the real resources side of the equation. You know, everyone thinks of, this is the way we talk about the economy, as if it's the some mystic, you know, idealistic thing in itself. And we talk about everything in terms of GDP and how healthy is the economy and so forth. So we pay attention to real resource constraint that underlies, you know, the digits themselves. And one of his sentences, I'm going to read it and then you can interact with it. But he says, quote, MMT's lack of interest in the relationship between money and the real economy causes adherents to overlook the connection between taxing, spending, and the allocation of resources. So I think that's a critique it's pretty useful to us. Do you want to comment or elaborate on that?
Sure. So here, let me just acknowledge in fairness, the MMT proponents, if they read that, and I know there have been responses, even in Jacobin magazine, I think allowed at least one proponent of MMT to respond to this article, they would pull their hair out and say, what are you guys talking about? We have always said that when we say that there's no budgetary constraint, you know, there's no legal statutory constraint, the U.S. government never needs to fear insolvency. It never needs to go bankrupt. It never needs to default on its outstanding debts. We're not saying it can just spend $250 billion and nothing bad will happen. Our point is that would cause unacceptably high price inflation. Right. And so that's the way they would handle it. And so they do acknowledge that there are real resource constraints. I think so. I'm just saying that that's how they would respond to Henwood's point. However, I do understand where Henwood is coming from, because most of what the MMT people hang their hat on are these nominal accounting tautologies. And so if you try to challenge them, they go, no, this is just, you know, this is just accounting, or this is just math, where, you know, they'll do things like say, oh, a government budget deficit equals the net increase in private assets. And when you parse the terminology and you understand what their claim is, yes, that's technically true. But then they use that to make it sound like, and that's why when the government runs a budget deficit, the economy does well, because the net, you know, the private sector on net is accumulating assets. And if you run a budget surplus, the government does, then the private economy has a net deficiency or downgrade in assets. And that's why, you know, you had all these crises that happened, right? So that's the way they talk. And so you're right. Their accounting tautologies are only true if you're just looking in terms of money flows and, you know, not worried about real resource constraints. So I think Henwood is right. And that's the Achilles heel of the MMT people, is they're too glib about saying, oh yeah, we can afford the Green New Deal. There's nothing stopping the government from printing up a quadrillion dollars. You know, they can do that. And then you say, okay, but if you did that, that would cause hyperinflation. And they might say, well, sure, okay, but that's a separate issue. You know, that has to do with demand management. And if inflation is too high, then you can cut spending or you can raise taxes. But, you know, let's stop talking about solvency and government budgets and whatever. Stop thinking like that. So they're kind of slippery like that, where, yes, if you push them, they will concede this is an issue, but they act like that's some distant afterthought, when it's like all you've really done is move the problem from one category to another. But when people say we can't afford the Green New Deal, yeah, what they ultimately mean is we don't have the resources to pay for it, you know, and so that we would have to draw resources out of other sectors in order to fund all this stuff. That's what it means to say we can't afford it. And so it's, you know, I think that, in other words, they're just quibbling over minor nomenclature when they're not really adding anything substantive to the debate.
Yeah. So, I mean, and Henwood seems kind of perplexed that this is even a topic. I mean, he doesn't really, I get this underlying, and maybe you got a different feel for him, but I kind of get this feel that he doesn't really take it as a serious threat. It's kind of like a trendy thing for now. But, you know, once more academics pay attention to it, it's kind of going to go back down under the radar again, because it's not something that can and should be taken seriously. What do you think about that? Do you think it's something that's going to be talked about more in the coming years? Or do you think it's something that's kind of a trendy for now, but, you know, maybe it'll disappear and, you know, we'll get back to traditional Keynesian talking points, you know, Krugman-esque type narratives?
Well, it's really interesting. So, my guess is MMT is not going away, at least anytime soon, because it's just so beautiful for what people like Bernie Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez want. You know what I mean? Like, they want to propose huge spending programs. They want to have a Green New Deal, and they don't want to have a carbon tax. That's what the irony here is. The left is actually not talking about carbon taxes anymore, where it's like moderate, quote, moderate centrist groups that are still trying to say, no, economists think that the best way to, you know, deal with the negative externality is to put a price on carbon. But people on the left realize voters don't want a carbon tax. You know, they don't want their gasoline going up $2 a gallon. And so they just, no, we'll just spend the money and we'll pay for it with the printing press. MMT, baby. So the left realizes the appeal of this, that you can promise whatever you want. And if somebody says, how are we going to pay for it? You just roll your eyes at them and say, oh, you need to look at MMT. Don't you understand how the modern system works? So I think that's why it's going to gain in popularity. And what's interesting is, I think part of what's going on is there's circling of the wagons among even Keynesians, not post-Keynesians, but regular old Keynesians, because they realize this is not good. You know, so Krugman, Larry Summers, Ken Rogoff, there's plenty of big gun economists who are Keynesian and associated with the Democratic Party who are coming out quite vehemently against MMT. And I think part of it is they don't want to, I think there's two things. One is it's just their turf battle, and, you know, they're more, you know, these older guys are more aligned with Pelosi and older, you know, established Democratic politicians. And so, you know, this 29-year-old Ocasio-Cortez is just waltzing, and all of a sudden she's stealing the limelight. What the heck, are you kidding me? You got to pay your dues. I think that's part of it. But I think even beyond that is just they realize this is nutty. And if we win in 2020, you know, the way they're thinking, and then the voters have been fed for a couple of years this line that, oh, yeah, we can get universal coverage and we can, you know, give everybody a job guarantee and universal basic income and all this stuff. And then the Democrats take power and the voters are going to expect that. And then we say, well, no, we can't actually afford that. People are going to flip out. So I think that's part of what's going on, is they're actually, to their credit, being somewhat responsible and realizing we got to nip this in the bud. Right now, Democratic progressives are being promised the moon and they're being told it won't cause any pain. Like, there's going to be no cutbacks necessary. We just need to print money.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, when I think of the establishments, you know, the sort of the crony relationship between politicians in the, you know, 20th and 21st century and, you know, sort of Keynesian orthodoxy, you know, you can kind of trace the path, you know, between the two and how they're connected and mutually supportive of one another. But did this MMT stuff just come into the equation because of people like Bernie Sanders? I mean, it seems like there has to be something more at the academic level that, you know, brought this forward. I know he talks about Kelton, but is there, I mean, where else is this coming from? It seems to be so sudden, and it can't just be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, even though she has, you know, Clinton on her team, it seems like there has to be another source of it all. Like, where, what platforms are, you know, pushing this, these narratives and these ideas?
So Kelton is a columnist. What is she at Bloomberg?
She's at Bloomberg.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. And so, and why do people care? It was because she's got some street cred now that she was, she was also on the budget committee or something like that for the Democratic Party. But you know what I mean? So she was, it wasn't merely that she was advising Bernie Sanders' campaign. She also held some official role, you know, in terms of people who were actively in power. So I think that's part of it. And so people are debating her. And but I think that it is just what we're saying. So Krugman, he did take a shot against, you know, across the bow of MMT a few years ago, like during the, you know, when we were still in the wake of the financial crisis, when Krugman was running around wagging his finger at the so-called deficit scolds, you know, in that phase of the, back when deficits didn't matter, you know, because once Trump got elected, then all of a sudden deficits did. But back when Krugman was telling everybody deficits don't matter, and if anything, you know, the government should run a huge deficit because, hey, we're at the zero lower bound and, you know, the Fed's out of ammunition, liquidity trap, blah, blah, blah. And Krugman did write at least one piece back then saying, you know, there's this school of thought called MMT, and I don't even really want to, you know, to put them in my crosshairs here, because right now we're both saying the same thing. We both agree people worrying about how we're going to finance these deficits are wrong and they're holding back the economy. But he did do a thing back then. So, I mean, it was on people's radar even back then. And when I debated Warren Mosler, it was because I had some people saying, hey, Bob, you know, there's this MMT thing, and everyone's just kind of saying it's goofy. But, you know, we as Austrians, we don't like that. And we're just dismissed as a fringe group. So, you know, why right, don't you take them right on? And so that's why I did debate Warren Mosler. And I wrote a thing for Mises.org, you know, several years ago talking about MMT and why I thought it was wrong. But yeah, in terms of why all of a sudden is it a big deal and why did I have Warren on my show, I think it really is just that Ocasio-Cortez talking about it all of a sudden made it a big deal. And then, and also Stephanie Kelton is pretty glib, and she handles herself well on Twitter. So in other words, if you were predisposed to like MMT, you would like the way she handles people on Twitter, you know what I mean? And the way she like interacts with Krugman and stuff, she's pretty good about it. In other words, she's good at framing it, making him look like the old fuddy-duddy who doesn't right, get it, and she's like with the cool kids. So they've done a really good job of framing it like that. And I mean, look, in fairness, or I don't know what to say, there's no easy way to say it, but I mean, you saw the stuff with the Green New Deal and those FAQs and stuff. I mean, the kind of people that would put out and then retract and say, oops, just kidding, saying, hey, it's going to take more than 10 years for us to totally get rid of air travel and farting cows. Someone who thinks like that is on the staff of Ocasio-Cortez. You know, the MMT is right up their alley. You know, I mean, that's if that's the level of sophistication where they're thinking, oh, yeah, we could just totally go to renewable energy in 10 years. Someone who comes along and says, yeah, and we'll pay for it by running the printing press. And QE didn't cause any problems, so why would this? I mean, that's the level we're dealing with here. So it's, I don't think it's, in other words, if Bernie Sanders is a serious contender to be the next president, you know, I don't think, you know, there's too much more needed to understand why is MMT popular all of a sudden.
Sure. So is there any noticeable difference between people like Warren Mosler and Stephanie Kelton? And obviously everybody has their quibbles and nobody agrees completely with one another, but is there any big noticeable differences in the MMT camp between these, you know, what you might call the you know, the blogger MMTers and the academic MMTers, or are they pretty much all on the same team overall? Or, you know, do they pretty much agree on, you know, the big things, you know, together? Or is there anything that you think is important to recognize nuance between the various parties?
As with any school of thought, the academics and the, you know, the professionals are more nuanced, and they're more able to grapple with opposing viewpoints and have a conversation, whereas the average partisan just, you know, on a Twitter comment is going to say something that's pretty dim-witted. So that's, you know, that's certainly true that.
But specific to Warren Mosler, though, I mean, is he a good resource to really understand who's behind Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of these people?
I think so. And to give you an example though of the differences. So Mosler, he, you know, he was being diplomatic about, but when I had him on my show, he expressed some mild reservations about the phrasing. So for example, the so-called job guarantee, that's a big plank. And that's this funny that Henwood in his piece, that's the one thing that he says is, you know, that he likes in the MMT platform. Mosler doesn't like that term because Mosler thinks, no, the idea, you know, because he thinks that phrase job guarantee is going to make the average person think this is just a black hole where someone's going to get on the government payroll and just be there for the rest of his life. And he thinks, you know, voters aren't going to like that. And in Mosler's view, no, it's a transition program. It's just a way somebody who, you know, loses their job in the private sector, the government, you know, comes in with a guaranteed position so long as, you know, you don't show up drunk and stuff like that. And that just allows you to stay working so that when you then try to get hired in the private sector again, you've got some experience. You don't have a huge gap in your employment record on his resume. That's the way Mosler thinks. So he doesn't like that phrase job guarantee, even though he likes the idea of, you know, once we're freed from the constraints of thinking we have to, quote, pay for everything, look at all we can do and we can, you know, permanently lower the unemployment rate, that kind of thing. Another difference is I want to get this right. It's something like some of the MMT people say the point of taxation isn't to fund government spending. And Mosler, I think, didn't like that way of, I mean, so they ultimately all agree on, you know, the basics, but Mosler just thought that was a clunky way of putting it. And that it was understandably sowing confusion in the minds of the public. And so I don't remember off the top of my head the way he wanted to say it, but things like that. So yes, Mosler, but I think they largely all agree, you know, with the basics, and certainly somebody who goes in Mosler's book on the seven deadly innocent economic frauds, you know, Mosler has things in there like, you know, governments don't need to first raise revenue through taxing to fund spending or something like that. You know, so he's got all those things in there that are staples of the way MMT is discussed.
Yeah, the whole jobs guarantee, pillar of the MMT narrative is interesting to me because on one hand, as we mentioned in the beginning, it seems to be this constant reference back to just the accounting mechanisms of money creation in the modern economy. And so that's why they take more of a descriptive instead of a prescriptive approach, or at least that's the way they frame it. But then when you get to the job guarantee, that seems to be something that's held closely to their heart as well. They all seem to be in favor of this job guarantee. Is that similar, or is that like their version of, the UBI, for instance? Is it kind of in that same vein of trying to provide something guaranteed for people, except for the MMT actually have a non-tax way of funding it?
Well, the difference between UBI and a job guarantee is under UBI in its pure form, the universal means everybody gets it. You don't have to be willing to work. So whether you lift a finger or not. So that's, whereas a job guarantee means you gotta show up to work. So that's one difference. I mean, they're both ways of trying to make people, you know, to ease their anxiety so that, you know, nobody needs to fear, oh, you're one paycheck away from disaster. So they both fulfill that function in terms of a, you know, leftist progressive worldview, but there is a pretty big qualitative difference that a job guarantee means, you know, it's a job, whereas UBI, there's no strings attached, not even saying you got to work, even at some, you don't even have to go like pick up litter or something. I mean, it's truly, you can sit at home watching Oprah and just get your check every month. That's what UBI is. But you're right. What's interesting about the job guarantee being part of this MMT umbrella is that that really has nothing per se to do with the basic MMT insights. And even Henwood here, he says, unlike MMT's monetary theorizing, the job guarantee has nothing to do with the school's core charterlist concept, and it deals directly with a crucial aspect of the real economy, namely the labor market. So I agree with Henwood's description there that it's somewhat interesting that this job guarantee is so closely associated with MMT when, strictly speaking, they have nothing to do with each other. Now, in fairness, I think the way – and I even asked Mosler this – I think the way he would explain the connection is to say, look, the job guarantee, you know, or again, he doesn't like that phrase, the idea of the government having a fallback, you know, safety net, call it what you will, where anybody who's you know, reasonably responsible can be employed, that's good for the economy. In other words, that makes sense to do. It's worth doing. It's a good program socially, economically, whatever. And the only reason you wouldn't do it under the gold standard mentality is just because of temporary constraints of financing. That, oh, we just couldn't afford to pay people those wages because we can't raise enough tax revenue and we can't convince private lenders to lend the government the money. Whereas once those fetters are removed and you can run the printing press, you're allowed to pay for things that totally make sense, that are worth doing. So I think that's the way he would explain it, that yes, this is a thing worth doing. And when you have the MMT insight, you realize there's nothing stopping us from doing it because it, quote, pays for itself in terms of real resources. And that last thing I'll say on that is this what I'm saying. A lot of the MMT stuff, the only reason it's relevant, the only reason it's worth going through this and recalibrating the conversation is if the fuddy-duddies and the orthodox people are fundamentally wrong about how the economy works. So that's why it's so misleading, I think, or glib when the MMT people say, hey, this is just accounting, because it's like, no, you guys have to think that there's systematically underutilized resources, particularly in the labor market, for decades at a time in order for this to matter, right? In other words, them thinking, no, the real issue is real resource constraints. Okay, but if you think that the economy left to its own devices, you know, achieves full employment and resources get allocated to where they should by the invisible hand, blah, blah, blah. If you're thinking like a classical economist, like J.B. Say, well, then to say, oh, no, the real constraint isn't financing. The real constraint is, you know, real physical scarcity. Okay, you've just, you know, changed the label, but it's the same basic thing. So that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that the MMT people, in order for it to be worthwhile to listen to what they're saying, they have to also, with the, you know, coming along with it, is they have to have a totally different conception about how the economy works, which is not a tautology, which isn't just a matter of accounting. It has to do with theories about what causes the business cycle or what causes, you know, high unemployment, stuff like that.
Right. Let me change gears here for a couple minutes. Because I'm one of the things that I'm really interested in is the Marxist theory of money, and I know that's kind of an arcane, you know, field of study, and we Austrians actually don't talk about it a lot, especially because we kind of live in the era of, you know, Keynes and post-Keynes. But Henwood distinguishes between you know, what he calls the endogenous money theory, which is, you know, an offshoot of post-Keynesianism, and he distances them this from what he calls the opposite of, you know, this endogenous money theory, which is monetarist theory, right? Milton Friedman and so forth. And he actually says that the Marxist theory of money is more similar to the endogenous money. So, like, what he says, how he distinguishes them is he says that monetarists, right, Friedmanites, believe that the central bank controls the money supply through its power to create and disseminate money via the banking system, right? So that's just the typical, that's what we learn about when the, you know, the Fed injects cash into the financial system, right? By having the treasury, you know, from buying treasury bonds from the private holders, right? I'm quoting from Henwood here. But then on the other side, there's the view, the endogenous theory, which is that money creation is driven by demand for credit coming from private actors. And we kind of hear, you know, some of this talked about when you know, in terms of when we talk about, you know, the Austrian business cycle theory, but can you interact with those two theories of how money is created? Because it seems to me like both are true under the, you know, under the current system. There's an element, fractional reserve banking does in part depend on, you know, private borrowers demanding you know, loans from the bank, but also the central bank does have the ability to inject cash into the system. So why is he distinguishing? Why are these two separate theories of how money is created if both are relevant today? I don't know if that made sense to you, but
okay, yeah, great, yeah, no, it totally makes sense. Yeah, so that's a great question. So here, let me I'll say some stuff and I'll let you respond. So, he's right that the monetarists, they had a great rhetorical victory in the 70s, right? People like Milton Friedman had been saying that the conventional sort of hydraulic Keynesian view of the 50s and 60s and the way the Phillips curve had been used was wrong, and that, you know, once people in the private sector, once labor union leaders and whatever caught on to the fact that the government was relying on inflation in order to push down unemployment, then they would just adjust their demands, right? Instead of workers being able, willing to supply so many labor hours for a given nominal wage rate, once they realized, wait a minute, you know, inflation's running 8-9% a year, they would boost their wage demands. And then even the temporary gains you got from running the printing press in order to push down unemployment would disappear. And so the way that would manifest itself is the Phillips curve would just shift. Okay. And so that was, that empirically happened. And not only did it happen, but people like Friedman and, you know, Paul Lucas, you know, Robert Lucas, they had predicted it ahead of time. You know, they had warned this was going to happen. So then when it did happen, you had the stagflation of the 70s, these guys looked like geniuses and the Keynesians were caught flat footed because depending on how crude the version of Keynesianism was that you were espousing, to have high unemployment and high price inflation at the same time should have been impossible. Okay, so then the monetarists, what do you guys say? And so Friedman had this, you know, famous rule about, you know, let's take the discretion out of it. Let's just have the Fed commit to a constant growth in the quantity of money over time so everybody in the private sector can just know that's coming so that, you know, the source of instability or uncertainty from the quantity of money is taken off the table and they can at least be sure of that. But the problem is the Fed cannot, even though the Fed can control what's called the monetary base, which is actual currency and Federal Reserve banks or commercial banks reserves held on deposit with the Fed. So the Fed can control that, but that's not when people say, you know, what's the total quantity of money in the economy? They usually mean something like M1 or M2. And there, yes, the public's willingness to borrow money from banks, that contributes to how, you know, how many total checking account balances there are, and that's part of M1. So the Fed, what they found in the early 80s when they did try to implement the monetarist approach is it broke down. And there's lots of reasons. I think partly like the Reagan tax cuts made the dollar more attractive. And so the point was the Fed, even if it did just try to let the base grow at a certain rate, it couldn't control how much M1 moved around. All right. So that was the problem. And so so that's one of the elements. Another way of seeing it is a lot of people have been giving pushback against the standard textbook approach. And Austrians do this too. When we try to explain Austrian business cycle theory and we say something like, oh, well, suppose the Fed wants to cut interest rates. What they do is they go in open market operations. They buy a bunch of assets that creates more base money. And then, you know, those reserves get deposited with the commercial banks. Now they have excess reserves and then they go and they want to make more loans to their customers and they have to lower the interest rate in order to induce people to move along the demand curve for loanable funds. And so that's the way in which the Fed can, quote, lower interest rates by buying assets, pumping in more base money, and then the commercial banks dutifully go out and mechanically make more loans and they lower the interest rate. And so the one of the sources of pushback on that is people will say, what are you talking about? Go actually talk to bankers, commercial bankers, when they're sitting around discussing whether to make a loan to a particular business applicant. They don't say, well, gee, what are our excess reserves right now? They just decide the loan on its own merits. Is this a good loan to make? And then if they're short, you know, if they're running afoul of their reserve requirements, they're legally required, you know, for this many checking account deposits with your bank, you need to have 10% set aside as reserves. If they're short, then they just go into the Fed funds market and they borrow the reserves from somebody else. And so that's like in terms of endogenous money creation, where they're saying it's the commercial banks and the state of the economy and do business. Do they want to borrow more or not? That's what drives everything. So I think you're right, CJ, that they're all actually correct. It just depends on what you're holding constant. So strictly speaking, if the Fed didn't create more base money and commercial banks tried to, you know, if they're all like, let's say the economy goes on an upturn, all of a sudden businesses are real optimistic and they all want to go borrow more from their banks to fund new factories or whatever at the current market rate of interest. And the commercial banks are like, oh yeah, this guy's very, you know, we looked at his balance sheet and this, it's, you know, we agree with the idea. We want to fund this. We want to make this loan. The loan officers are signing off on it. But, oh gee, we don't have enough reserves. Let's go in the Fed funds. Well, all the commercial banks can't be borrowing reserves from each other, right? They'd be scared. So that would push up the Fed funds rate. And if the Fed didn't do anything, well, then that would raise the market rate of interest. In other words, why would a commercial bank make a loan at 4% to some business borrower when the Fed funds rate just got bumped up to 7% because of the scrambling to obtain funds to satisfy reserve requirements. So it kind of goes the other, you know what I mean? So what would actually happen in practice is if the Fed had committed itself to a Fed funds rate of 2%, because that's what the target was, once they saw pressure in the Fed funds market and the federal funds rate went above what the Fed's target was, the Fed would dutifully do what the textbook said, and they would buy more assets, increase, you know, pumping base money in the system, and that would push down the Fed funds rate. So that's the sense in which you could say it's the commercial banks who are running the show. But really, that's just because if we're assuming the Fed is going to pick a particular federal funds rate as the target and that's what it's going to hold constant, then yes, commercial banks' lending activity could, in effect, force the Fed to either inflate or deflate in terms of reserves. But again, it's so both sides are making factual statements. It's just what they're holding constant when they say this is how this process would unfold.
Yeah, I appreciate you verifying that for me, because it always seemed so perplexing to me, because, and maybe this is because I came to all of this, you know, my understanding of things, whether it's accurate or not, from starting from ground zero, right? From reading Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money and understanding where money comes from, then coming to his chapter on the central bank and, you know, recognizing the role that the central bank plays in this very complicated fractional reserve system with central banks and you know, commercial banks and so forth, that it always just seemed to me, well, it's got to be both at play. And just the very idea that you would emphasize one over the other seems to be sort of a disease of focusing only on policy and never theory. Okay, the last couple minutes, I wanted to see what you thought about Henwood's accusation that the MMTers, quote, have a lot of complicated relationship with the facts. So it's kind of toward the bottom. You probably remember it, but basically he accuses them of just not even having a basic understanding of, you know, what the how the government spends its money now. So he says, because, you know, Stephanie Kelton, she just said that, you know, during the Great Depression and so forth, the New Deal more specifically was, they created money out of thin air. So she said, look, if they did that during the New Deal, then it's pretty obvious that they could do it again today. And Henwood basically says, you know, that's just a basic, you know, factual mistake. That's not how they funded it at all. They didn't go out and, you know, create the money. They actually had to borrow it. So what do you think about his interaction with their, you know, just basic factual mistakes, you know, about, you know, historical occurrences and events?
Yeah, I love this. This was great. So for the benefit of your listeners, one of the things that MMT people do is they'll say that, you know, oh, you know, nowadays the way modern monetary systems work, when we have a country like the U.S. where it's a fiat money system, and again, the debts are denominated in terms of the currency, the local currency. They'll say things like, yeah, when the Treasury spends money, all it does is it instructs the Federal Reserve to credit the bank accounts of the recipients of that spending. So there's no issue of can we afford to do that? They just tell the Fed to credit their, and that's just wrong. And so I like how Henwood put that. He said, but the government doesn't do that. It spends only money gotten from tax revenues or bond sales. And he says in parentheses, if you don't believe me, look at a daily Treasury statement, a daily accounting of the federal government's income and outgo. It looks a lot like any normal financial statement, only with a lot more zeros. Okay, and that's the thing too. And I was trying to hunt that down. And so, yes, like, so what the grain of truth in it is the Treasury does have a general account with the Federal Reserve, right? So it's like the Treasury has a checking account, not with Citibank, but with the Fed. And so, yes, there is a sense in which if the Treasury pays $1 million to some sanitation workers, you can think of that and describe that as, oh, the Treasury is ordering the Fed to credit, you know, the banks where those sanitation workers do their banking. And so their checking account balances go up by the amount of their paycheck when they cash the paycheck. But at the same time, the Fed debits the Treasury's account. So there's nothing special there. Just like if JP Morgan pays, you know, money to somebody who banks at a different bank, you could describe that and say JP Morgan instructed the Fed to reduce its own checking account balance with the Fed and to increase the balance of, you know, what some other company with the Fed, you know, their balance. So there's nothing special there. The rub comes in, what if the Treasury tried to spend more money than it had in its balance with the Fed? And the MMT people act like the Fed would just create the money. And no, that's – I mean, maybe they would, but it's – that's not statutorily what's left. So they're acting like this is just standard practice when, as Henwood has said and I've been saying – that's just wrong. Like, so that's the irony. This is like supposed to be the bedrock principle of MMT upon which everything else rests. And actually it's wrong. It's not true that the Treasury has some special ability to just spend money in an unlimited fashion because it just tells the Fed to print it. The Fed could say no. So now you can argue behind the scenes, maybe the Fed would accommodate and blah, blah, blah. But in terms of the actual mechanics, just looking at it in terms of how does the money flow and what's the relationship and what does the law say, they're just flat out wrong when they talk about how it works.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I wanted to go here in the conclusion was, I mean, on one side, let's say they were right about the actual legal mechanics of money creation. On, you know, if all their claims about that were accurate, then we could bring back theory to them and say, okay, but there's real life consequences. There's real resource effects of doing it this way. So it's kind of like the example you give, and you can state it more clearly than I can about, you know, the theft situation, right? So they could be right about the mechanics of it, but that doesn't make the economy, benefit from these activities. But on the other side too, if they don't even get their facts right, then we have an entire other layer of critique that we can offer, which is basically what Henwood does here. I mean, he says specifically that the Fed is actually forbidden by law to purchase the bonds directly from the Treasury. The Treasury can't just, you know, interact with the Fed like that because, you know, of course, the Fed deals with, you know, primary dealers and there's kind of this middleman situation. So even their basic facts are wrong. So even if we, even if their facts were correct, we would have theory to say, okay, there's real life consequences. So you can't just do that without having negative side effects to doing this. But even beside that, it seems like they, and I don't know if they are misrepresenting the real life situation, the legal situation, or, you know, on purpose, or they actually just don't understand it because they have a simplistic view of how it all works. I don't know. And maybe you have insight into that. And maybe there's variance between MMT proponents in regards to whether they're being misleading or whether they actually are unaware of this basic reality.
I don't think they're willfully saying something they know is wrong. All right. So I think they genuinely believe that what they're saying is correct. And I think the way they would, like if they heard you and me talking right here, or if they read Henwood's piece, I think they would just dismiss that and say, oh, you know, that's some trivial little procedural detail. In essence, that's not a big deal. And so that's partly why when I'm grappling with MMT, I don't put a lot of weight on that one particular thing because they could just change the law, right? So there's a thing called the modern greenbacker, you know, the greenbacker movement. And that's what they said. They said, why should private bankers have anything to do with money creation? Get them out. Just the Treasury spends money. And if it wants to spend more than they took in taxes, just run the printing press. Problem solved. Right. So certainly governments could do that. And, governments around the world where they have hyperinflation, you know, I haven't gone and researched every single one, but it's possible that they basically did do that. So that's why I don't put so much, you know, I put a huge amount of time when critiquing MMT into saying, by the way they describe stuff is actually wrong. But it is worth pointing out that it is wrong, especially since, you know, the thing they pride themselves on is, hey, we're the ones just doing a positive description of reality when no, they're not. So I think to answer your question, CJ, they would think that's a trivial little detail and oh yeah, sure. Technically the Fed, you know, the Treasury has to get money into its checking account by floating bonds. But the way that money comes into existence is because the Fed has monetized that debt. And so really it's just a big, you know, shell game. And it's ultimately what we're saying. Like they think they're cutting through all the particulars and petty little details and getting to the essence of it when, you know, we're pointing out that, well, no, that's actually not the essence of it. An example would be during, you know, there was a period under the QE programs when it was like, if you looked at a particular fiscal year, I don't know if it was calendar year, but it was like, if you looked at the increase in the federal debt that year or the amount of outstanding Treasury debt and how much Treasury debt the Fed added to its balance sheet, it was something like 80%. So in theory, those were independent things that Bernanke was doing, you know, his quantitative easing programs just in terms of the dual mandate and unemployment and inflation. We don't care about Uncle Sam's finances. And the Obama administration was running fiscal policy. But I thought behind the scenes they were connected, that the Fed knew the Treasury's borrowing a lot and we got to make sure interest rates don't spike, so let's go ahead and monetize it. So I think that's where the MMT people are coming from. So just like I might have said in a radio interview or something, like, oh yeah, the Fed's monetizing the debt right here, or the deficit. And, you know, and they're saying basically the same thing, but they think it's a more permanent thing, not just something that was kind of extraordinary happening during those years of QE. So I think that's where they're coming from. And in one sense, depending on one type of conversation, yeah, that those are trivial little details. And I'm fine just to say, yeah, the way it works right now is the Fed monetizing. That's how the Fed finances wars. You know, if you want to talk like that, what you mean is, well, technically the federal government borrows money to then go buy armaments, and the Fed creates dollars with which to soak up the you know, treasury securities at the so there, if somebody's saying how, yeah, the Fed financed World War One, you know, you somebody comes along and says, well, no, actually, look at the legal state. So that's where the MMT people are coming from. But I'm just pointing out, you know, strictly speaking, the way they're saying it works is not how it works in practice. And since they put so much weight on that fact that they're giving, but you're right. Ultimately, the big deal is that the important thing is to say, even if it did work exactly as they say, that's not solving any problems because, yeah, there's real resource constraints. And all you're doing is giving the government a way to shunt resources into politically motivated channels. And that's not the way to help the economy.
Okay. And let's finish on this, because what you said right there was basically basically from the reciprocal, the exact opposite position is kind of where Henwood's coming from. He's saying, look, in pursuing this MMT, these various MMT proposals, you're actually not solving the fundamental economic issues. And of course, the issues to him are things like exploitation and workers' rights and some of those more Marxist themes, because, you know, that's where he's coming from. But he's basically making a similar point that we would make, namely that you can't just fix the actual real economy that's behind behind the curtains that money covers up. You can't just fix them with a keystroke, is the phrase that he continues to use. So do you have any, final words on the fact that, you know, this Marxist is trying to peel back the fundamental distinction between, you know, money and the real economy? And so when all these MMT advocates are proposing that we use monetary policy to fix the economy, they're actually missing the point, because the economy itself is something that's distinct from the money. And, you know, that's something that kind of ring true to us. Of course, we wouldn't focus in on things like exploitation and Marxist themes, but we would focus in on, boom and bust cycles and some of that element and inflation. And so do you have any conclusion on that side of things? Just this interesting, I'm just looking at his last two paragraphs here, and he's talking about the fact that it doesn't matter how much money you print, how many keystrokes you initiate, you can't solve the actual issues in the economy itself via the monetary mechanisms.
Right. So yeah, you're right that Henwood, even though I agree with 90% of what he says, and also a lot of it's just descriptive, you know, explaining this is the intellectual roots of this stuff. So clearly, you know, that's, I think that he knows more about it than I do. And I see no reason to doubt what he says. But you're right. His ultimate rejection of MMT, and the reason he says the title of this is Modern Monetary Theory isn't helping, is you're right. He thinks this is like a technocratic fix that's going to just distract progressives and certain democratic socialists, when just funding a Green New Deal, for example, or universal health care or whatever, that's not going to address the fact that some people are allowed to own six mansions while other people are homeless. You know, I think that's kind of where he's coming from, that the kind of thing that an actual Marxist looks at is the flaws with a capitalist system. You can't take capitalism and turn it into a socialist economy just by letting the government spend a lot of money. I think that's where he's coming from. And so I think that, yeah, he's worried that this is just distracting a lot of the real, you know, highbrow progressive activists who could be led to understand the problems with capitalism per se in Henwood's worldview, are getting distracted by this, you know, flirtation with something that really at best, the job guarantee, okay, yeah, that's pretty good, but the rest of this is just nonsense.
Right, basically, because if the problem of capitalism is that capital is held by private individuals who invest that capital for the sake of profit, just letting the government, you know, run the printing press, so to speak, isn't going to actually solve that problem and get the capital ownership into public hands, right? That's basically his perspective on it.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, in fairness, I think somebody like Ocasio-Cortez could say, what are you talking about? You know, people are scoring our thing. We're going to spend $93 trillion in the first 10 years. And part of the way we're going to address these inequities is, you know, by giving everyone, I mean, if you read the Green New Deal stuff, it's pretty generous. You know, it's not just, oh, someone getting the bare minimum so they don't starve to death. It's like people being able to get a good job where they can support a family and and have paid medical leave and all. I mean, it's pretty generous. So everybody would be at least middle class if the Green New Deal actually did what it purports to, and it would solve the climate crisis and you know. So I think that's the way they would try to address it. But you're right. I think Henwood's ultimate problem with it is saying just having the government spend a bunch of money, that's like old, you know, regular Keynesianism. We're just going to fix fix some of the gaps in raw capitalism, but it's still basically going to be private property. And if some people want to, you know, end up having a million times the net worth of others, so be it. Whereas that's obviously not what his, you know, ideal society would look like.
Yeah. In a way, that sort of radical take on it is kind of, you know, we can kind of see ourselves not in his, systematic critique of it, but more in the, you know, printing more money is not going to solve the actual economic problems, because there's more fundamental issues at hand than just the Fed coming up with a better algorithm or a better, you know, methodology of determining the correct interest rates or money supply or you know, what have you. So in that sense, you know, it's helpful to think about the economy beyond just the, you know, the nominal side of things, which is what so many policymakers focus on. But let me read the last two sentences here, because it's fun polemic. He says, it would be sad to see the socialist left, which looks stronger than it has in decades, fall for this snake oil. It's phantasm, a late imperial fever dream, and not a serious economic policy. So that's basically his two sentence summary of what he thinks of it. And I think Jacobin Magazine has published a couple other dissents from a Marxist point of view from this. But in any case, I think it's an issue that's going to be relevant in the coming years, especially when we live in the era of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and sort of this, free. It's nice to have free goods, but it also would be great to have the free money pay for the free goods. So, all right. Well, that's all I had. And unless you have any other thoughts, I appreciate you taking the time to talk through this article with me. And I will link to it and any other resources that you want to send me, Bob. I'll link to them on the show notes page, which will be austrolibertarian.com/episode9.
Thanks, CJ. Yeah, I guess the last thing I would just mention is I have found that, you know, I applaud you for really delving into and following a lot of these people, that actual Marxist scholars are very intelligent and they know, you know, they've heard of the socialist calculation debate, you know, and they have their set of research. So I would just urge, you know, Austrian, Rothbardian type listeners to not just say, oh, what are you talking about, Marxist? They're much more sophisticated than like somebody who likes Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, right? So these people,
yes,
they know the current system is screwed up and they just have a totally different way of trying to fix it. But I think there's a lot more to be learned grappling with an actual Marxist than like, you know, somebody who's getting their PhD in economics from MIT, for example.
Yeah. And since you mentioned that, I guess I do want to say too that, you know, not all democratic socialists are in the same ilk as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which is, you know, who's basically just a good marketer. She's popular on Instagram. And in a democracy, you know, you get people like that, you know, that come to the top. But, you know, underlying that whole movement, there is a lot of people who have thought deeply about these issues and do have the capabilities of having very serious conversations with us, you know, Austro-libertarians, regardless of how, you know, how deeply we've dug into, you know, Ludwig von Mises, et cetera. They are worthy opponents intellectually, I think, and it's worth taking the time to understand their arguments and coming at them with a serious tone.
Yeah, I agree totally.
Thanks, Bob, for joining me. Let's do it again. MMT is a reminder that the Austrians have so much to offer the world, and the insights of the Mengarian tradition are for the ages. For more episodes, make sure you visit austrolibertarian.com/podcast. Thank you for listening, and make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or in your favorite podcast app. See you next time.
Well, there you have it, folks. That was my discussion with CJ Engel about MMT through the eyes of a socialist. Hope you enjoyed it. If you want to see links for any of that stuff that we discussed, I will give you a link to his original hosting of the interview. So you just go to bobmurphyshow.com/25 in order to see that. And I didn't do an ad in the middle of the thing. I wanted to spare you guys. So don't worry. We do have plenty of original material for the Bob Murphy Show coming soon. And just stay posted. You'll see it soon.
You've just experienced another episode of the Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.